think that a lot more people listen to podcasts now, and I hate to say nobody has time to read books anymore, but it's, you know, the information is so quick out there that, you know, podcasts and books on tape and or audiobooks and just listen to clips, you know.
You spend 30 minutes in the car and you cover down on it.
I do. Every morning I either listen to Fox News or I'm listening to MLB Sports or listen to my audiobooks. So, yeah, it's a great way to learn if you are if you fall into that learning category of being an audible learner.
Yeah.
Then it works perfect. So, I'm an audible, kinesthetic, and then also a, you know, visual learner. So, I have to hit all three. So, reading, listening, and then actually like doing is how I have to learn and get proficient at. Yes, sir.
Conducting amphibious operations is part of the Marine Corps' DNA, and amphibious vehicles have been a critical component to the Marine Corps operations since their introduction during World War II. The names and models have changed, but one thing has remained constant since their development. Before many of them first crossed the surf in the Pacific, they most likely spent some time in the shores of California at a small test facility called the Amphibious Vehicle Test Branch, or AVTB. The mission of AVTB is to plan, execute, analyze, and report developmental and integrated test and evaluation events to characterize the performance of amphibious and ground combat vehicle systems to inform acquisition decisions. In other words, they are put through their paces on and off-road courses, and then they face the surf of the mighty Pacific Ocean before a decision is made to make them part of the fleet. Since its inception in 1940s, AVTB has been at the forefront of amphibious vehicle testing and continues to be DOD's only test center specializing in testing, evaluating, and developing the Marine Corps' present and future amphibious combat platforms. AVTB has been the focal point for all generational upgrades of the amphibious vehicles since the LVT, or the Landing Vehicle Tract, which was critical to the success of the Pacific Island Hopping Campaign of World War II. During the preceding decades, AVTB maintained an integral role in testing many of the variant upgrades of the AAV, the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle, the Marine Personnel Carrier, the Amphibious Assault Vehicle survivability upgrades, and most recently, the Amphibious Combat Vehicle. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with AVTB Director, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Granero. Did I say that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Scott, before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to join the Marine Corps.
Sure. So again, my name is Scott Granero. I was born in Guam and then to two Marine parents. Both my parents were active duty Marine sergeants. So being born in Guam, I got a lot. I always get the questions of, are you a U.S. citizen? And I have to go back and say, yes, I am a U.S. citizen, not only because both my parents were Marine stationed in Guam at the time, but also because Guam is a U.S. territory. And you'd be surprised at how many people just don't know that.
That's true.
So I always found that kind of interesting fact. You know, after my parents left Guam in 1984, they moved to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where I spent majority of my life, where my dad continued to serve and my mom got out in 1989. So we spent majority of my time at Lejeune and in Jackson, North Carolina. I graduated from White Oak High School there in Jacksonville, and then proceeded to go to the University of North Carolina at Pembroke back in 2000 through 2004. So during that time period, a lot of change happened in the United States, especially with the attack of 9/11. And there I was in college on September 11, 2001. I just woke up to get ready to go to class, and I remember turning the TV on and seeing all the stuff that was going on. And at the time, my dad was still active duty, and I knew that my dad was supposed to be up in the Pentagon during that time period. So my first, you know, instinct was, oh, my God, what is going on?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, from that point on, I knew immediately after that moment had happened that I needed to join the Marine Corps or join the service to go serve my country, because I knew there was something on the horizon based on those events. And I actually went to go talk to a Marine recruiter not too long after that happened. And I remember going in there and talking to the recruiter and telling him I was in college. And then the words of, you know, wisdom from him was, hey, we don't know what's going on. Go back to school and, you know, think about it. And if you want to come back and talk to me later on, the door is always open. So I talked to my dad. I talked to a really good friend of mine who was at the time a sergeant in the Marine Corps, and got a lot of good information and a lot of wisdom from them. Fast forward a few years later to 2003, as we were preparing for the invasion into in Iraq. I again was adamant about joining the military because I did not want to be kind of left out. I wanted to have a part, and I wanted to say, you know, 30, 40 years later, you know, that I had a part in, you know, now what we call Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. Right. And so with that, I went back to a Marine recruiter, and this time Marine recruiter said, "Hey, you got way too many years of college. You need to go up to Raleigh, North Carolina, and go talk to the officer selection officer." So I was like, "Okay, I'll do what you tell me." So I ended up going up to Raleigh, North Carolina. I sat down with the OSO, Captain Walker was his name, and I'll always remember that name. And we kind of talked about the Marine Corps and being an officer and what the difference was between an officer and enlisted. And he talked about leadership. And from that point on, I knew that I could handle being a Marine, the physical aspect of it, but being a leader was something that I always liked doing. And talking to him about being a leader of Marines was something that I felt that was right for me. So from that moment on, I took my initial PFT, signed the paperwork, and then waited to hear back about being a Marine officer. And then fortunately that summer, right before I graduated college in 2004, I got the word that I was accepted to officer candidate school and never looked back. And so here I am almost 18 years later, still serving. Never thought I would be, you know, serving this long, but I'm happy I have, because again, being a Marine officer and being a Marine in general is just, it's been something I've always wanted deep down inside. And it was really good to be able to finally make that come to fruition.
Well, that's outstanding. I think most of us join and, we look forward to doing some things for a few years of our life. And then next thing you know, time flies when you're having fun. But congratulations. Let's switch over to AVTB now. You've been here almost a year.
That's right. Okay. Just under a year.
Now, you've got a large gathering here of both Marines and civilians. Can you tell us a little bit about the setup and structure here?
Sure. And that is one of the core assets of this this branch, is really our people and how we're kind of structured. When you look across AVTB, what makes this branch very unique is that we have a wide range of people that work here at the branch, to include Marines, government civilians, and even contractors. And what's really unique and really awesome about this team here at AVTB is that everybody's always all working together towards a common goal, which is, testing of the Marine Corps' next generation amphibious capability and whatever else we're testing. So, you know, on the Marine side, we have some of the best in the assault amphibian community that come here to serve. A lot of senior NCOs come here to be vehicle operators for our testing. Our test directors are some of the best staff NCOs the assault amphibious community has to offer, who come here and run these test events for us as the directors. And then we also have some of their, Major Halley, who's my deputy, is, you know, one of the best in his business when it comes to the assault amphibian community. And, again, he helps me ensure that, you know, a guy who's a non-Amtraker by trade and as an acquisition professional, make sure that the decisions that are made here are done correctly in line with SOPs from the from the Fleet Marine Force in regards to ACV operation or right. Just anything in dealing with the amphibious environment. So, and then from our civilian side, one of the things that is really and just blows my mind every time I think about it is just how much resonant knowledge and expertise there is here within the branch within our government civilians. When I look down at my my engineering section, I've got about 6 or 7 personnel that have been here for well over almost a decade or so. So when you add up all the number of years that of experience that my test engineers down at the engineering section, it's well over a century worth of experience. And that is something that you can't replace, you can't make up for, you know, that experience. So, you know, that's a great aspect of the branch. You know, they were here from, some of them have been here since the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle days back in the early 2000s through the AAV Survivability Upgrade right. program and all the way through the Amphibious Combat Vehicle program. So they have a great deal of experience and provide that on a daily basis for testing.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, obviously that's expertise you're not going to grow overnight.
That's correct.
And that's expertise you're not going to, you know, just find anywhere else. So the amount of knowledge that's resident here. So fascinating. I appreciate you sharing that with us. Now, I know that ACV testing evaluation has taken up a good chunk of your time. How much focus is the branch still doing on ACV?
So the ACV will, you know, will be a part of the ACV's life all the way through the end of its life cycle. We still, you know, we'll have ACV testing requirements as the system continues to, new variants continue to be fielded to the FMF. Any type of emergent testing requirement that may pop up, you know, the branch is going to have a part in it. For example, a few months back, there was a safety use message that was pushed out, which prevented ACVs from going into the water. And so our test branch was instrumental in working with the program office to determine a tow rope solution, so that way the ACVs could get back into the water. Because the second and third order effects of that is when the ACVs don't go in the water, Marines don't train. And when they don't train, you know, that's a capability that we need to make sure that our Marines have. And because that's the bread and butter of the Marine Corps, is our amphibious capability.
I'm glad you touched on that, because a while back we had an episode with Colonel Tim Howe, who manages PM AAA. And so he was enlightening us a little bit, you know, a rope is not a rope is not a rope. So the rigor that went into evaluating what was taking place here, just with that capability, is fascinating. And I think you hit on another key point. I mean, AVTB has been here since the 40s. We fielded AAVs back in the early 70s. You've been part of their life for the last 50 years now, and you continue to do things to test, evaluate, provide safety. What are some of the other things? You're still working on some AAV stuff here, or your focus mainly ACV?
So our primary focus has really been on the ACV, specifically on their personnel and command and control variants that is in the process of being fielded to the FMF. So that's been really our focus, specifically with reliability testing, follow-on reliability testing. We've done a lot. So when I first get on deck, you know, welcome to AVTB. You know, we're going through this, you know, long series of reliability, availability, maintainability testing by the engineers. And again, it was a great way for me to learn the ACV, because again, my background is engineering. I'm not an Amtraker. And, you know, it was a great way for me to get a good feeling of what the vehicle system can do and some of the challenges that it faces. You know, with the ACV, another program that was going on simultaneously was a foreign comparative track testing that we were doing for AAV at the time.
Oh, yes.
Which is where we were looking at a more of a rubber tread or track than your traditional metal track. And they were looking at whether, you know, again, we were just doing some analysis on how it would perform inside a water mobility environment. Okay. So that was some of the things we did for them. But other than that, as we all know, the AAV program is slowly but surely divesting and sunsetting itself as we transition more into the ACV family of vehicles.
So I know you do have some land capability here as well. Obviously, we talk about the water, but you do have some land capability here as well. Can you touch on that a little bit?
We do. And so one of the things that one of the areas we're very fortunate to have is the AMPA, which is a amphibious vehicle training area that's right across the way from our branch. And that area is just large enough for us to be able to go out there and do any type of limited slope testing, allows us to drive around and get some additional miles in the vehicle for reliability testing. And then we also have the wide ranges available to us here at Camp Pendleton. What makes Camp Pendleton very unique is the fact that, you know, in the old, when I first moved here to California, they said you can go surfing in the morning and then go skiing at night and be surfing right back later on that evening. And the same can be kind of said here in the Camp Pendleton area. You know, from early in the morning, you can be doing a open ocean swim with your vehicles, coming through the surf zone and then transiting it throughout the littoral, you know, from a mountainous environment into a desert environment. So when you look at everything that Camp Pendleton has to offer in regards to like a testing environment, we have everything. You know, we have a robust testing environment for both land and water mobility testing requirements?
I think one of the things that's probably important to maybe share is that you execute the test plans for the programs. So you have an assortment of capabilities, engineering, test capabilities and things, but the programs themselves bring you their test plans. Is that a fair statement? Or ideally what they want to do to the capability?
Yes, and what we do is we'll work with the program offices and we'll develop the detailed test plan.
I got you.
So we'll look at their performance specifications, and then we'll develop the detailed test plan based on what the program office is looking for us to test. From there, you know, once the test plan has been drafted, we'll push it back to the program office for the review, and then eventually we'll sign it, and that will be a document between us and the program office of detailing, you know, what that test plan looks like, what are some of our objectives that we're trying to meet in regards to, you know, testing the system's capabilities. And again, that way, it's a document that will outline the length of the test, what we're actually testing to, and then some of the almost a statement of work between us and the program office, right, about what we're going to do for them and what we support them in regards to their testing. Because like you mentioned earlier, our job, we don't really speak on behalf of a specific piece of equipment,
right.
Or capability. What we do is we test those performance specifications to ensure that what the prototype or the vendor is providing is meeting those performance specifications outlined in the detailed test or in the capabilities development document that are driving all those performance specifications. So with that, you know, the way we like to think of ourselves is a kind of a supporting role in regards to providing all that test data back to the acquisition decision makers, so that way they can take and make the next decision to advance the program or whatever they see fit with the information we provide them.
But it's interesting that you say it really is a collaborative effort, because in order for a program to understand how much they want to do, you really do a little bit of a presentation on here's what we can do. How far can I stretch this vehicle? How far can I stretch this test? So that's your role, your team's role, I should say.
Yeah, and again, the way we look at ourselves is we kind of look at is we're here to provide an environment for you to be able to test those specifications that you want to validate that the system can do. And that's the way we look at it. So again, I like to think of us as kind of that supporting arms capability, that supporting effort to the main effort, which is the program offices. I like to make sure that, you know, and that's why when we look at what we have here in the branch and the capabilities we have, you know, I'm looking to grow those capabilities, mm-hmm, because I want to make sure that the information we're providing the program office is the best information possible. You know, and I'll use, for example, like our meteorology lab where we have all of our instrumentation, which provides scientific, you know, data collection capabilities, you know, for us to, you know, put that information together and provide, you know, that information to the program office. So, you know, one of my main efforts, you know, from when I came in here, priorities is to really modernize our testing instrumentation capabilities. So whether it's data loggers, whether it's our surf array system, which helps us determine like wave heights and length, that help us provide better information to the decision makers. So that way, at the end of the day, they know that the information they got has been is not really. You're trying to remove out all the errors, all the human factors that go into sometimes test collecting. So we're trying to remove that stuff out so that way they know that the information they're given is solid information.
So I think, I mean, you hit on a great point, because this is, I find this fascinating. You know, for the novice in me, I'd say, oh, okay, they take a ACV, they splash it in the water, they swim it around, they bring it back up, but it can take you weeks, sometimes months, just to prepare and do the grunt work, so to speak, to make sure you have stuff that you just talked about, the meteorology capability. And I'm not a scientist, nor do I play one.
But. No, and neither am I. You know, I'm, like I said earlier, what's unique about this branch is is our people. You know, from our engineers, civilian engineers, to our civilians that run the, you know, our meteorology lab, who are, you know, skilled people when it comes to electrical engineering. They understand some of the systems, this instrumentation. It's amazing when you see a vehicle prior to it actually being tested, like you talked about, like it is as simple as putting a vehicle in the water and swimming it around. But, you know, to get all the data that you need to inform the acquisition decision makers. We use this instrumentation, and a lot of it requires a couple days worth of outfitting the vehicle, you know, to get, you know, to either ballast it to gross vehicle weights, or put instrumentation on there that will help archive it via, whether it's video or any other type of, you know, information we need to pull from the system. It takes a couple days to do that. So there's a lot of preparatory work that goes into outfitting the vehicle prior to going to test. So that way, at the end of the day, the information we do pull is, you know that it's a solid product that we're providing. And it's not somebody, how, you know, Marines like to call it, stubby pencil method.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
We are actually
using
we're using sophisticated programs, call it MATLAB or MATLAB, and a few other programs and other computer generated processes that help us gather this information. Because if not, then you have some Marine on the beach trying to determine wave heights, and not saying that that's always, you know, it's pretty accurate, but at the same time, it doesn't always give you the, all the information that you quite need to have to understand what's going on while the vehicle's under test.
So I've been out on some of those waves. They weren't quite 3 feet like they said. I think they might have been a little bigger than 3 feet. So I got to tell you a little secret. So I've been coming here. Well, I haven't been here in a few years, but I started coming here back in 2009. And I know you've been here almost a year, and I got to share this with you. This place has grown. Not necessarily in space-wise, but the capabilities you have here. It seems that it's a lot more capability out in your ramps and in your bays and whatnot. So it really has taken off. I know in the past you've had, before your time, but there were times here where you hosted four vendors at once doing evaluations on their vehicles. And it's hard for people to imagine putting four different companies in the water all at once, and your team was still able to preserve the integrity of each of those companies to be able to do their own thing. Have you had any experience as of late with doing some stuff with industry out here? Or is this something that, you know, perhaps you see in the future again?
Kind of two points to that. So we have, having multiple vendors here in the ramp simultaneously. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to have some very professional individuals that are able to work through many different types of problem sets. And, when you look around across the ramp and, you know, just the facilities we have, there's a lot of space that we're able to use to position, you know, different vendors in different locations, you know, put up some screenings so that way there's no chance of, you know, intellectual property being, right, you know, leaked out. So again, you know, we afford them that. And then again, when we're out here, I have enough safety capabilities. Like one of the things, that I find very unique about this branch is the amount of safety that we have associated with it. We have multiple ribs, the rubber hulled inflatable boats that we utilize for safety boats and for recovery purposes, that I'm able to do multiple tests simultaneously with those capabilities. And also with our vehicle sets we have, we do have, you know, older AAVs that we use for recovery, for right, for land recovery and other means. And again, that allows us to be able to do multiple simultaneous tests and at the same time do it in separate locations, so that way we're not, you know, not letting intellectual property out and kind of giving them their space to be able to operate and do, right, their testing.
Right. As an engineer, you rode in some AAVs way back in the day.
I was saying, I found it very funny when I got here. One of the first things I mentioned about my first Amtrak ride in 29 Palms, I was a young lieutenant with 1st Battalion, 6th Marines. So I was the engineer platoon commander. And we were doing mine clearance line charges, shoots, okay, with from off the back of the Amtraks. And so I get to go, you know, here I am, brand new lieutenant out there in the God's Country 29 Palms, and shooting MCLICs with the Amtrakers. You know, it was our final MCLIC. I think at the time we were 10 for 10. So we had 10 fires, 10 detonations, which is pretty good when you're, you know, 100%. And on the way back, I just remember sitting there bouncing around the back of the Amtrak thinking, you know, how miserable of a ride it was because it was so bumpy. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it was a good relationship. It was awesome, you know, getting that first experience as a young lieutenant. So, and the reason I bring that up is because when I got here, I made that comment to somebody, and I said there was one particular staff sergeant that I remember. His name was Staff Sergeant Pyluk, and I would start talking about it. And next thing you know, somebody's like, "Hey, I know Pyluk. He works over in the net trailers." So, you know, I had to go over and reintroduce myself and say hello. So, you know, again, it's funny how it comes full circle. You know, here I am, a lieutenant, never think twice about ever running into an Amtraker ever again. And here I am, you know, taking over as the director for the test branch. And now retired, Mr. Pyluk is down there. And, you know, I got a chance to go meet him and tell him how awesome of an experience it was for me to, you know, to experience that Amtrak ride for the first time through the desert of 29 Palms. So
this is an awesome location here. I mean, you have the schoolhouse across the boat basin. You have third tracks here. Do you have an opportunity to interact with them on a semi to pretty regular basis, or what's that relationship like?
I do, and we always like to refer to the 21 area as a very unique ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because when you look at the boat basin here, you know, you have AVTB, you have the Assault Amphibian Schoolhouse, and then you have 3rd Assault Amphibian Battalion, all working together here in the 21 area, whether it's trained Marines on how to operate the amphibious combat vehicle or the AAVs, Marines who are actually going out there in employment and operational environment, and then you have us testing them. So when you really look at it, it's a very unique ecosystem because we all rely on each other for multiple things. The schoolhouse relies on us to kind of help with the new equipment training. Like, we provide safety boats for their new equipment training that is worked through the program office. Third Tracks and us, you know, anytime we have a test that comes down from PMAAA, until I receive my ACVs as part of the fielding plan here in the near future, I have to rely on either the schoolhouse or the Third Tracks to provide, you know, that ACV,
the resources to do that testing.
So again, it helps to, you know, have that working relationship with both those organizations, because not only, you know, do I assist them, and, you know, if there's a challenge like the tow rope solution, right, with me testing as quickly as possible so we can get that solution, you know, work that, get that information to the program office so they can work that that solution, because the second order effects on that is the Fleet Marine Force. You know, once we were able to get that and the safety release message was lifted, then they can get back out there and start training, and which is a good thing, because we need that, you need that training. Those Marines need to get out there and learn their skill and learn their trade, especially with the new program that, you know, that we see today. So
there's nothing like hands-on, the ability to actually put your hands on a piece of gear and have it do what it's designed to do.
That's correct.
I know you've touched on this a little bit, but and as it relates to ACV and different variants, but what's next for AVTV?
So I'm glad you brought that question up.
What's on
because
the horizon?
So I will tell you that since the day I got here, that has been on my mind. I spent the past 4 years in Okinawa and living Force Design and kind of seeing some mm-hmm. of the things that were coming back from here. And when I got to ABTB this past summer, and I looked at everything we did here, I was like, this is exactly, you know, the best organization in the Marine Corps to advance littoral kind of relook at the focus of the littorals, like with the Force Design 2030,
right,
and say, yep, this is the best organization to do testing for anything that's material solutions that's going to be utilized in a littoral environment. So I've been, you know, spending the past like 9 months talking to staff, observing, and trying to see how can we be a better service to the Marine Corps at large and the DoD by providing testing capabilities. You know, when you really look at, you know, Force Design 2030, in the Commandant's vision, and just what we're doing with expeditionary advanced based operations and littoral operations in the contested environment, you know, this is a perfect organization to test anything that's going to be utilized in those environments. Not only do we have, you know, Marines and civilians that have been working amphibious vehicle programs since, you know, for many, many years, but, you know, you have the littorals of, you know, Camp Pendleton, you know, 20 plus miles of coastline, that in all the training ranges out there that can support, you know, both the water mobility and land mobility testing requirements. So why not ABTB? So what we're looking in the future, you know, what's on the horizon is how do we maintain our, you know, primary responsibilities, which is supporting, you know, the Marine Corps' amphibious capabilities, but also opening the aperture, really kind of informing the rest of the Marine Corps about what we can do here at the branch, and then reaching out to them and bringing some of their water mobility requirements that they may have in their program, specifically ones that support, you know, Force Design 2030. And as I look to the future, some of my guidance to my staff is really, how do we posture ourselves? How do we restructure? How do we modernize our instrumentation and our testing capabilities to be postured, ready to receive or test equipment that's going to be, you know, look to be tested here in the near future as we start to develop more requirements, more material solutions that are going to be utilized in a, you know, expeditionary advanced base type operations here in the near future. So that's what we're trying to do with this branch.
I think in some ways, I mean, you've touched on a lot of things, but I think in some ways you and your team have already validated a portion of the Commandant's planning guidance. I think this has been a place where you've taken some of these capabilities and you've said, hey, it can do X, Y, and Z and be able to support the future mission in this respective area. The Commander General Pasajian likes to say, these are exciting times, but they really are exciting times. This is, this is an evolutionary change for the Marine Corps. And congratulations to you and the team because you're part of that change process that's taking place. Now, I got to ask you, you're an engineer. You're not a novice to AAVs, and I'm sure you've spent a little time in one or two or a few before coming here. So you had some background in it.
I did. And the great thing about engineers,
Blow up stuff all the time, right?
We do.
I just want to make sure I get that straight.
Yeah. And, you know, and now I'm an acquisition professional now. I'm an 8061. Okay. But, you know, and I'll share that later on about, you know, why I made the decision to go acquisitions and not stay engineering. But one of the things that I tell all my my Amtrak, you know, brothers and sisters here within the branch is that, yeah, I may not be an Amtracker, but we share a lot of commonality in the sense where, you know, we grew up, I grew up in the combat engineer world or with the combat engineer battalions. As a young lieutenant, where you are directly supporting the infantry battalions. Mm-hmm. And just like the Amtrakers who directly support the infantry battalions and provide them that mobility capability, you know, we understand what it means to be a supporting effort for the infantry. You know, we share a lot of commonality with that. And at the same time, we rely on each other because when you go into a breaching operation, you know, which, you know, used to be something that, you know, we used to always pride ourselves on is mobility and breaching capabilities is whenever you did like any type of breaching scenario, whether it's sand table or you actually were out 20 on palms going through a live breaching scenario, you know, you're working alongside the Amtrakers, whether you're shooting a Mark 154 at the back of a triple shot, AAV, or you're shooting off the back of a trailer or riding in the back and creating your entrance and exit funnels and your rails for your assault force to go through once you make the breach. We had a lot of good relationships and a lot of working together to, and again, that's why I think I'm a great fit for this organization is because I'm complementary to what they do here. You know, I bring my experience as an engineer and as an acquisition professional, take what they provide as Amtrakers and kind of work to come up with some great solutions.
So I got to ask you a couple more questions. When did you make the transition to acquisition?
So I made the transition acquisitions in November of 2020.
Okay.
So I was currently in the G3, 3rd MLG in over in Okinawa, and I was contemplating on whether or not I wanted to, what I wanted to do next in my career as a Marine officer. And, one of the things that I was very fortunate, I spent 3 years at the program office working for Mr. Joe Klosak and Mr. Jack Cave, who was and Jack was at the time the PM Engineer Systems and, PM of Combat Support Systems.
Yep.
And Mr. Joe Klosak was the product manager for Engineer Systems. You couldn't have asked for two better former Marines to kind of mentor and kind of give me this understanding of what acquisitions is and the impact that you can have at the enterprise level. And like I said, when I was sitting there, kind of looking at force design and I wanted to have a part of, a larger part in the transition of the Marine Corps into the Commandant's vision for force design, I started saying, what could I do more? What could I help out more, whether it was in acquisitions or in engineering? And, talking to my family and, looking at what was, for me, what I thought could have more impact on the enterprise at large was going acquisitions. And so at the time, it felt like the right decision for me. And, when I got selected for it, I was extremely happy because I know that me becoming an acquisition officer meant that I was going to have more of an impact at the enterprise level. And maybe not necessarily today, but by 2030, you know, when you know, you look back whether I'm still active duty or retired, I can say that my efforts, you know, went to bringing that capability to the Marine Corps and preparing us for, you know, our future, you know, future operating environment. What we all look at is, you know, our pacing threat out in the Indo-Pacific and just kind of preparing ourselves for that potential adversary. Very similar to what we saw, you know, in the interwar periods between World War One and World War Two. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like, you know, my role as an acquisition guy kind of helps look back. You know, when they look back at this time period, they'll say, hey, a lot of things were done right that helped set us up for the next potential conflict in the near future.
I think that's a great summary. And I work with Jack on a regular basis, so I may be a little bit biased, but I'll certainly have to give him credit for a good recruiting effort on his part. I got to ask you one more question before we jump into what many consider the favorite part of the show. But before I do that, I must ask you about a tradition that went on here for many years. But unfortunately, like so many things, COVID has hampered, I believe, for the past several years now, the traditional Christmas parade that you all used to do here. I know it's before your time, but I understand Santa used to ride an AAV during the boat parade and give out toys. Is that something you hope to envision to bring back in the future, in the near future?
Yeah, you know, and
I don't want to put you on the spot convince you to anything.
No. And I'm glad you brought it up because that's one of the things I've been talking to my guys about was, you know, COVID across the board, both in the Marine Corps and just in civilian life, has really kind of impacted how, you know, a lot of traditions and a lot of ways of how we interact with each other. And one of the things that, you know, I'm committed to with the branch is, and I told my staff this, is that we need to start getting back into, you know, doing some of our traditional things, you know, like the ABTB did in the past, like right. This. You know, that's one of the things I asked my staff to look into is, like, any opportunities we have to go out and do something within the local military community, you know, that's something I really want to do. Whether it's, you know, once we are fielded our ACVs and
I was just going to say, I don't want to get ahead of yourself, but Santa may want an upgraded vehicle.
Yeah, you know.
So you may have to wait a year or two until you get something
here. Yeah, and, you know, and I'm all for it. Like I said, I think that the best thing for our branch to do is get back to some of our traditional things. Because, again, what makes the branch so unique is our people. And, you know, when you take away the abilities to kind of, like, come together as an organization, you lose or you potentially lose some of that that team effort, that team unity. And, you know, again, things like the Christmas parties, Christmas parades, ABTB is known for their annual boat races that they do out here in the boat basin. You know, when you take those away, you know, you lose a little bit, the morale kind of goes down, and it's good to see things coming back online because it increases your morale. And again, this organization, what makes it so special is its people. And if you don't have happy people, then you know it's going to be very hard to keep those good people around here, this branch, to keep them working.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, this has been a great conversation for me because I have a soft spot for AVTB. I mean, I deployed out of here. We were in a different spot on the base before the MEF transition down here. But it's so great to come out here every opportunity I get to do something. I think you've got an incredible team here, an incredible capability. I don't think you've even gotten anywhere close to where your potential is. You got a lot of activities going on, so I'm going to let you get back to work. I want to thank you for making the time to join us today. But before I let you go, I got one more thing we usually do around here at the show. So are you ready for the lightning round?
Sure. Fire away.
I'll bring it on. So what's your favorite duty station?
My favorite duty station so far has been Okinawa.
Okay. I thought you might say Guam, but you have a different
time. I was born in Guam. And because of COVID, I unfortunately was never able in the 4 years I was there to go back and visit. Wow. So I promised my mom that sometime here in the future, I will make my way, whether it's Space A or I'll buy a plane ticket and fly out there. But I got to make my way back to my birthplace. So,
well, I commend you for that. That's great on your part. What's a TV show, a book, a movie, or a podcast you'd recommend?
Honestly, I haven't had much time to watch TV or even read books because of you know, finishing up a master's degree through Naval Coast Graduate School.
Great.
But I will tell you that two things have been very beneficial for my time at Naval Coast Graduate School doing their distance education program is one is the acquisition research articles they push out. Mm-hmm. And also the Naval Institute was a good one. You know, one of the things I highly recommend is that, you know, get your hands on those Marine Corps Gazette. Read those, you know, real quick articles, because it helps keep you informed of what's going on throughout, you know, the fleet, whether, you know, Navy or Marine Corps, and even expand it out a little bit and look at some of the business side of that, you know, outside of the Marine Corps, outside of DoD, and see what's going on in industry. And then the last part of that one, you know, and it's something that, you know, I've started, you know, me on a professional level, and I highly recommend people is, you know, start reading more about becoming better writers, better how to write not only like information papers, but how to do better research. And the reason I say all this is because there's a lot of smart people in the Marine Corps who have a lot of great ideas, but the number one thing they fail to do is put it on paper and get it published for everybody to hear. And I will say that I've listened to many people that have some great ideas about force design and how to, you know, better prepare the Marine Corps for, you know, the future, but what they fail to do is get it on paper.
Again, I'm a little biased here because, you know, if they would do that, it'd probably make my job a little easier. I do dabble on reviewing a few point papers from time to time. So, but I got to throw in a plug here. You mentioned the Gazette, and I think it's spot on. So I got to tell everybody out there, if you get a chance, get your hands on the May edition of the Gazette. It's a great acquisition edition. A lot of great articles in there. So thanks for bringing that up. So if you weren't doing this, if Lieutenant Colonel Scott Granieri wasn't wearing that Marine Corps outfit, what would he be doing?
If I could do whatever I wanted right now, and again, had the talent to do it, I'd be playing professional baseball just like every American boy out there, you know, or girl that would want to play professional sports. You know, again, the opportunity to play baseball professionally in front of thousands of people would be something awesome. However, I do live in I am a realist here, and I understand that I wasn't born with those God-given abilities. But if I wasn't a Marine, I'd probably be doing something in line with the service. One of the things that really fascinates me is the forestry. I would love when I retire from the Marine Corps to potentially maybe get a job, you know, later on doing, you know, working for the national parks as a park ranger, or even being a firefighter working forest fires out west, out in the national parks or anywhere up in the areas that are been impacted by forest fires. Because I just find it very fascinating. I'm all about service, hence the reason why the Marine Corps is a very good organization for me.
I think I'm going to have you talk to my oldest son, because, you know, he went through 6 years of school, graduated from Virginia Tech, and he works for the State Parks of Virginia. So, and he loves being outdoors each and every day. Just looking at the weather here in your office, it's a great place to be. If you had any superpower, what would it be?
So if I could have any superpower, it would be to stop time. And, you know, and again, I forgot to mention this when we talked about our introductions. Like, I forgot to mention, like, my wife and my two sons. But
we were saving the best for last.
Yeah,
you got to be able to segue right into that.
My wife and I have been together for almost 20 years now. We met in Wilmington, North Carolina, prior to me coming into the Marine Corps. She had grown up in a small farming community called Williamson, North Carolina, which is not too far outside of Greenville. Had no military experience and had no idea what the Marine Corps was all about. However, she stuck with me through the past, 18 years of service, and has been there while I've been deployed for, you know, to Iraq and to Afghanistan, and raised my two boys, Colin and Luke, who are now 13 and 10, and done a phenomenal job of ensuring that whenever I'm not there, that they're taken care of. And,
I got to ask you, either one of them baseball?
They are. They're both. Right. They're both.
Stick to it, because I 20 years under my belt of going to all them games, and I got two boys that went through high school, played there, you know, so.
Oh, yeah.
I see that in your genes.
Well, you know, I will tell you this: they both have a love for baseball.
That's awesome.
I hope that they also do Boy Scouts. I hope they fall in my path and earn their Eagle Scout rank, which I hold near and dear to my heart. The reason I say stop time is a couple reasons. One is I've taken for granted how good my wife is taking care of our family, and you come home and you're really tired, and you know. And sometimes, like, the kids will ask, hey, Dad, can we go outside and play catch? You know, can we go do something? And, you know, you kind of blow it off because you're like, hey, I got, you know, we'll do it tomorrow. But, sometimes you always think to yourself, like, man, you can't do that. You know, if I could stop time, because I look back and I miss the days when my kids were, you know, want to come sit on the couch and cuddle with you. Now they're, you know, don't want to have anything to do with you sometimes. So, you know, again, when I talk about stopping time, it's really to stop time, to spend more time and really appreciate all the things you have. You know, that's the reason why I'd want to stop time, you know, and have that superpower.
Now, I can't tell you how meaningful that is as somebody whose youngest is 20 now. It certainly, the years go by and they go by rather quickly. But listen, you sound like you got a fantastic family, and that's half the battle right there, having somebody on the home front taking care of things for you. I want to say thank you for your time. Again, I want to wish you all the best of luck with everything that you do here, and keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for your time.
Hey, no problem. All right. Hey, thank you for coming down. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk about AVTB and our people and what makes us so unique and our kind of our vision for the future and what I want to do for for the Marine Corps at large and provide this capability to them.
Thank you. Well, this concludes another episode of Equipping the Corps. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation today. If so, please take a couple minutes, leave us a review, subscribe, tell your friends about us. Till next time, Manny Pacheco signing off.